Today I'd like to say something about the fundamental way in which Luther thought. He was overwhelmingly biblical in his thinking, and as a result of that, in reflecting the Bible, Luther's views end up being profoundly paradoxical, very difficult for most of us to cope with and to understand, and we're uncomfortable with it. And so I thought I would establish as much discomfort as I could by pointing out, as well as I can, how profoundly paradoxical Lutheran is and how profoundly paradoxical the Lutheran tradition has to be if it correctly understands not Luther, which is perhaps not so terribly important, but the Bible, which is, of course, of much greater importance. So that's what I'm going to talk about. I once suggested some themes along this line to a group of smart alecks and asked them what paradox was, and they told me Dr. Kildare and Ben Casey. That's not what I'm talking about. If you're interested in reading about it when you get home, there's a very good book that has a very bright chapter on paradox, from which I have borrowed quite a bit. Happily, the book is not in the library here, and so you can't tell how much I've borrowed. The book is by J.S. Lale, an English scholar, and it's called The Protestant Tradition. And one of the early, he has a marvelous section on Luther. It's a very, very good book. And he has one of the early chapters deals with the paradoxical nature of Luther's thought, and I recommend it very highly. In the introduction to that book, Quayle suggests that Luther was not very well or correctly understood, has not been very well or correctly understood for most of the time since the Reformation. And that, of course, is true. He was buried under the weight of tradition. He was buried under the weight of interpretation. And what Luther actually said, and the way he really was lost sight of almost immediately. Perhaps it's always that way with heroes. They become somehow larger than life, and what they really said and did disappears, and what people kind of mythologically assume they said and did occupy center stage. It's only in the 20th century that Luther has been understood again as he really functioned in the 16th century, as he really spoke and thought and was in the 16th century. Much of this is a result of German scholarship commencing in 1883 with the celebration of Luther's birth, 400th celebration of his birth. A whole publication of his collected works began to take place at that time. They found buried materials all over the place, and kind of digging Luther out from the accumulated debris of 300 plus years of scholarship began to take place. That German scholarship, after a time, moved to Scandinavia, especially Sweden, and the German scholarship of the 20s was augmented and extended by Swedish scholarship in the 1920s and 30s. The English discovered that scholarship in the 1930s and 1940s, and much of the best Luther work in the 40s, right after the Second World War, came from a group of English scholars, most of them nonconformists, that is, most of them not Anglicans, but Methodists or Congregationalists or Presbyterians. J.S. Lale was a Congregationalist. Gordon Rupp, one of the other great Luther scholars, was a Methodist. Philip Watson, another one, was a Methodist. It was only in the 1950s that American scholars began to pick all this up and work with it. And the American Luther scholarship, that is significant, is a product of the 50s, but especially the 60s and 70s. One draws upon all of those traditions, of course. In the introduction to the book by Quayle, he says that Luther can be read and understood in the 20th century in a way that has not been possible before for three reasons. He said, first of all, the 20th century is realistic. He didn't mean by that philosophic realism, that old Platonic Aristotelian business, but he meant that the 20th century has begun to see things as they really are, I was trying to say, and begun to see things realistically. Living through two world wars, the threat of destruction, depression, the overwhelming problems of the present have brought us to the point of seeing things as they are, and of seeing mankind as it really is. Not pleasant and rising on a wave of progress, as was believed in the 19th century, that people were getting better, that civilizations and cultures were getting better, and that progress would continue ad infinitum into the future. We don't believe that anymore, do we? We don't subscribe to a notion of progress. We even argue that one can't, as a Christian, believe in that sort of thing, I suppose. Whereas 19th century Christians did subscribe to those notions in the most wholesale fashion, people were getting better, life was getting better, everything was getting better. We look at that with a sort of jaundiced eye. And Luther, like St. Augustine before him, is a pretty helpful guide here, because Luther's views about the government and culture were not overly optimistic. His view of mankind was not an optimistic one. His views about God's activity were, of course, optimistic, but not about human activity. So Whale says we can understand Luther, first of all, in the 20th century, because we share his view of the nature of man and of culture. I don't know if you do or not, but I think maybe that's a generalization that makes some sense. Secondly, Whale said we can understand Luther better because we are in some significant way existential in the 20th century. That is, we're not interested in great schemes of thought presented in a kind of abstract way and how we fit into those schemes of thought in a sort of immovable abstract way, but we're interested in life as it moves and pulsates and surges, and we try to respond to those pulsations and surges in a reasonable, but more importantly for Christians, a meaningful sort of way. And it's all moving for us all the time, isn't it? And so we have to respond to situations as they move along, and most of our decisions are made in that way. Maybe you live in a sort of immovable, abstract world where everything is always very simple and nothing changes, but I don't. Everything is surging on all sides of me, and as I try to make decisions about things, it seems as though I'm on seven merry-go-rounds at the same time, and I'm forever suffering a sort of nausea that makes it hard for me to orient myself in the present. This is what Paul Tillich called the boundary situation, living on the edges of boundaries all the time, trying to orient yourself and having to make decisions, not with a sort of flat universe from which you have a perspective where you can see everything, but in the midst of mountains and movements and I don't know what all. So we live in a boundary situation, Tillich said, and we have to make decisions from our imperfect minds in a kind of unsettled way, and that's very difficult. Luther is helpful at that point. Thirdly, Whale said, we find it easier to understand Luther because our age is paradoxical and has tried to come to terms with paradox, and Luther was overwhelmingly paradoxical. He said that Luther was too close to the Semitic genius of the Bible and too close to experience to establish a systematic theology, to build a systematic theology, you know, one ABC, two ABC, where everything fits together. Luther will drive you crazy because he's unorganized. He writes about things as he is moved, he responds to problems, and he dashes out these marvelously moving and exciting pieces of work, but they're not organized and related to the last piece and related to the next piece that he writes, and he never provides an outline in the introduction which says, you know, here's where I'm going and here's how I'm going to get there. It's a kind of great explosion, a kind of passionate explosion full of marvelous insight, but one that doesn't defy the laws of logic, it just ignores them. Luther wasn't opposed to logic. He thought there should be more of it in life. He just didn't use it when he wrote. Okay, he's too close to experience and to the Semitic genius of the Bible to submit to a systematic theology. Rather, he responded to situations. He tried to deal with problems when they arose. And the result is the work that we have. His successors in the Lutheran tradition did submit to the demands of a straight waistcoat of theology, to a systematic theology, and built systematic theologies again, following the lines of Aristotle, and they end up looking more like the late medieval theology that I talked about yesterday than Luther's theology, and much of that is what came down to the Lutheran tradition, strangely and ironically enough. Maybe, this is an aside, maybe none of us are brave enough to live in a world where we don't have a systematic theology to guide us. Maybe we all need a set of rules to look at, okay, here's the problem, here's the answer. That's why we mangle revelation when we interpret it. That's why we resubmit ourselves to the law, because we want rules and laws, because we can't stand freedom, right? Right. Okay. Luther demands freedom. He requires that you live in the midst of freedom, and he doesn't want to be to kind of suffocate people with his systematic kind of explication of things, and so he responds existentially and paradoxically. All right. The profoundest truths of Christianity, he argued, can only be explained in terms that are kind of mutually irreconcilable. That is, two notions are presented which are kind of opposite to each other, and he doesn't say they are true in turn. He says, in effect, that they're true at the same time. And we say, oh, come on, Luther, let's not have that. But he reflects the Bible in this, doesn't he? Because the Bible suggests the truth is of that sort. So Luther and the Bible before him suggest that there is life and death, or that the most basic truths of Christianity emerge out of the theology of the cross, that the victory of Christ comes out of this dreadful derelict, the death of a derelict hanging on a cross, or that there is mercy and wrath. Not that these 3 inches of wrath over here are merciful, but that there is somehow buried in the midst of wrath mercy. How is not mathematically explainable. So the modern scientific mind hates paradox and this Semitic kind of understanding because it doesn't conform to the way in which we have thought for at least the last 3 centuries. Since at least the time of the scientific revolution, we have thought logically and mathematically and empirically, and we think that that's the only way that truth can be presented, and we want to take those methodologies and apply them to theology and to the Bible, and we want the sort of clarity that science presents to us. It works or it doesn't work. Well, it's not that easy with science, actually, but we think it is. And we want to apply that to the Bible, and it ends up being a sort of crowbar that we kind of pry apart those biblical paradoxes, and we want them in turn, but we don't want them in some fashion kind of all wrapped up together. I suppose we mangle the Bible pretty badly in that process, don't we? Well, the group participation today is that we are going to go around and everybody has to give me one paradox. You know, mercy and wrath is mine, now what's yours? The theology of the cross. You get the idea, I think. That's what I'm talking about. Okay. One of the commentators on Luther says that everything profound that Luther says always has something hidden under its contrary. That is, the important thing is always hidden under its opposite or its contrary. Mercy and wrath. The mercy is, I suppose, the important, but it's always buried under or hidden under wrath. Victory comes out of the death of the derelict on the cross. So that when you're dealing with Luther's theology, you always have to look for something buried under its contrary. You find that hard to understand? Should I stop for a moment? You can shut your eyes and deal with that. I don't think that's easy to understand. And you have to kind of enter into a mindset that is not ours in a very real way. But that's the way Luther functions. And as he is a biblical theologian, par excellence, I think that's the way the Bible functions too. I can give you a couple examples of the difficulty of this, I think. In the first lecture, I said something about the ways in which Christianity is kind of combination of Hellenic thought, Greek thought, and Hebrew thought, Hebraic thought. The biblical tradition is Hebraic, full of paradoxes, full of a kind of understanding that is not conceptual. God is not defined, the attributes of God are not defined, rather God is described using similes or metaphors. God is a living fire, Yahweh. You can't even spell out the name of Yahweh, it's impossible. Whereas the Greeks are forever giving attributes and spelling things out logically and giving lists and trying to get everything as clear as you can possibly make it. And our civilization is a result of a combination of those two ways of thought, just as Christianity, Christian theology is especially a combination of those two ways of thought. Theology gives you indigestion, it's with good reason, I suppose, because it tries to bring together things that are, if not mutually irreconcilable, at least almost mutually irreconcilable, and the tendency of all theology is always to fly apart. It only is held together under the most incredible kind of tension. And once the tension is removed, it flies apart and you've got a big fat mess, theologically. And our theology is forever flying apart. And we've always got a big fat mess theologically. That's one of the things that the Christian community has to forever do, is to kind of tend to its theology and put it back together again. But the task is an endless one because it'll forever fly apart. Because we're trying to make clear what is something, from the scientific point of view, less than clear. Do you remember that the Greeks, do you remember your ancient history, that the Greeks thought, in a sense, in two different ways also. This is an analogy now, it's imperfect, but I'll try it on you. On the one hand, the Greeks tried to do things that were rational. They discovered reason, as a matter of fact. They discovered thinking as we understand it. Logic is a part of that. On the one hand, the Greeks functioned in that way. Discovered mathematics, in a sense, discovered much of science, discovered logic, all of that. On the other hand, the Greeks were also irrational to the nth degree. They were full of emotion and creativity and passion. We call the one Apollonian and the other Dionysiac. You can call it passionate and rational, if you will. And what the Greeks tried to do at the height of Greek civilization in the 5th century was to keep them together. They tried to keep passion and reason together, and the greatest products of Greek civilization are a product of a time when passion and reason were held together in an almost perfect tension, so that Greek tragedy is full of the most profound emotion, but it also follows the rules of Greek life, so that it pulsates with emotion, but the outcome is always the same. Violence begets violence, the tragic hero falls, it's all predictable, but it's done not mechanically, but passionately. Or Greek art is full of, on the one hand, the most enormous creative passion and energy and creativity, but it always follows very strict rules that it can't escape from. So that you look at a Greek statue or a piece of Greek architecture, and the creativity of it just kind of staggers you. You want to just kind of quiver with excitement, but it's always under severe restraint. It's always controlled absolutely, like a first-rate poem or a first-rate novel. What happened after the 5th century was that the reason control is released, and the passion kind of explodes, and so you get those statues that are out of proportion and those buildings that are somewhat out of proportion and the literature that is a little bit out of proportion, and it's asymmetrical after that. This is a long analogy, and you may have forgotten. I perhaps have forgotten why I'm using it. The point is, I can give you a more recent example. Are you moved by the music of J.S. Bach? Okay. Well, it's a Lutheran group. What else could you say? It seems to me that one of the reasons we are so moved by the music of Bach is that there is enormous creative energy in Bach, but it follows the rules perfectly. And so the energy is contained within the rules, and it's about ready to pop out, that it's always controlled. And so one is kind of staggered by that. One is just, perhaps all really great art is that way. The creativity is controlled by the rigor of reason and restraint. It's never too much. It's never in excess. It's always maybe just a little bit restrained. But the passion, you always think the passion is there. Well, it's very hard to keep that together, and the Greeks were able to keep it together only for a very short period of time. It's very hard to keep paradox together, too. I guess that's my point. And Luther was able to keep it together, but his disciples were not, and we find it difficult. But isn't that our biblical responsibility? Isn't that our Christian responsibility to keep together what the Bible keeps together and not look at only one part of it? But it's very, very difficult, and it's a kind of existential operation where freedom and loneliness, at least sometimes, are a part of it, and where you have to take your responsibilities seriously, and where you can't slip into one or the other side. I'll try to describe the two kind of sides that one slips into in all of this. Now, if all of the things I've said for the last 15 minutes are hard to understand, just forget them all. And I'll start over again and describe a couple of the paradoxes, the kind of staggering, earth-shaking, head-rending paradoxes that are present in Luther
and in the Bible. And you tell me whether you think you agree with the, what I'm saying about both Luther and the Bible.
I suppose the most basic, the most fundamental, one of the most basic and fundamental paradoxes in Luther's thought is that of law and gospel. Luther says that the preacher, when he stands up to preach, preaches law and gospel. Not law or gospel, not law one day, gospel the next, but he preaches law and gospel at the same time. Now, you know that the Old Testament was the book of the law, and the New Testament is the book of the good news, the gospel. Hasn't the gospel now replaced the Old Testament, one might ask Luther? And he, in response, says, no. The gospel is still relevant. The law is still relevant. The law still applies. It has been, in a sense, kind of culminated or brought to a fruition by the gospel, but that doesn't eliminate the gospel. Were you at the Bible study in Revelation this morning? The people who established the seventh kingdom want to pretend that the law is now no longer relevant and that one lives in an age of freedom where one can kind of do it. Often, they argue this way, can do what one wants. Luther at that point said the law still prevails. One is still guided by and has to be obedient to the law. Well, now, if Christ has come with his good news, why does one have to be still obedient to the law? And Luther argued, because that's the way it is, I guess. That's the biblical message, that the law is still relevant. So, the gospel has replaced the law, but the law still exists, and one has to be tied to the law. And Luther describes the law in the most extraordinary and dynamic kind of way, and then relates it to the gospel. He uses a number of images to describe what the law is. He says, the law is a hammer. The law is something that is preached and announced, and it is a hammer, and it drives people to their knees. You try to perform what the law says, and you can't, and you're driven to your knees. So the law is a hammer. That's a powerful kind of image, it seems to me. If it were eliminated, of course, there would be no hammer, and no one would be driven to their knees. When you're driven to your knees in desperation, in anfechtungen, in anguish, in angst, you look and see that the gospel indeed saves you, and you embrace the gospel. And that happens, he says, daily. The sinner has to die daily and be reborn. It's not something that happens once and for all in some sort of revival movement. You are simultaneously sinner and saved, and you have to recognize your sins, be driven to your knees by the law, and receive the gospel. I think that's a paradox. Okay, he says the law is also a mirror. It enables you to see yourself for what you really are. I've said a little bit about that earlier. You're like Kurtz in the Heart of Darkness. You see yourself as you really are, and you shrink away and say the horror of it all. You can't save yourself. This is what Luther saw as he attempted to save himself, as it were, in the medieval salvationary schemes. He was unable to pull it off. And finally, in desperation, he said, I don't love God. I hate God. If you try to save yourself following the rules of the law, you can't do it. And the result is desperation. And then you turn and see yourself, see grace as it really is, accept that grace, and understand still once again that salvation is free. Aren't you smart enough so that once that happens, you'll recognize the next time that you can't, in some self-righteous fashion, save yourself, and you don't have to go through this process again? If we were true Christians, I suppose that would be the case. Luther says true Christians are rare birds, and it doesn't happen, or at least it doesn't happen very often. Maybe it happens someplace, sometime. But it doesn't happen because we are kind of egocentric at our very core, and we always set out thinking we can do it ourselves. We always establish our own idols, our own self-righteousness as a kind of idol, and that sin has to be daily destroyed, and the way in which it's destroyed is through the hammering blows or through the mirror images of the law
which allow us to see ourselves as we really are, or which drive us to our knees. So the law is a hammer, or the law is a mirror, and it can't be dispensed with. You can't do without it, because otherwise self-righteousness would prevail everywhere. He says also, and this is very difficult, I think, and it's related to virtually everything we've been talking about this week, I think, in one fashion or another. He says the law is also a mask. And he talks here about the masks of God, and I think Luther is more difficult and more troubling at this point than perhaps in almost anything else he says. He says, God wears masks. And the sinner, in his desperation, has to find God, or salvation is not possible. So he sets about looking for God, and he looks for him all over the place, on the top of Copper Mountain, on the way to Holden Lake, on the golf course. I don't know where one looks for God. And God can't be found there, because while it is God's creation, and while God inhabits every part of the universe, he can't be found where he didn't say he would be. Can he? He is there, but he can't be recognized. He wears masks. So you walk up to the top of some mountain thinking you'll have a mountaintop experience. What else would you have there? And as you look for God in some satisfying, salvationary way, and just as you think you're going to confront God in some revelation, God pulls the mask down and he can't be seen. All you see is nature. Can God be found in nature in a saving way? Of course not. Now, here's the test. If you pass this, you get at least a C in the course. Tell me, I don't know if you're all Lutherans, that's not important. Where can God be found? Where can God be seen? Where has he promised to be in a saving way? First of all, in word, and where else? In word and sacraments. Have you ever wondered why word and sacraments were so important in the Lutheran Church? Why the sermon occupied that central portion of the service in such an important way? That's because the word is at that point proclaimed, and God can be recognized there in a saving way. Christ is available there in a saving way, and also in the sacraments. Can he be seen in a saving way anywhere else? No. I'm not a theologian, but I think that's theologically correct. That's what Luther said at any rate. He is present, but he can't be seen. He can't be recognized. He wears masks. So you look for God everywhere, in your own activities, in teaching people, in helping people, in healing people. I don't know what you all do. But you try to find God in some special way there so that you can be next to God and somehow substitute this for the hearing of the word or the participation in the sacraments and the sort of dynamic activity that has to result from that, and you can never find it. All you see is an image of yourself. All you see is your own egocentric nature at that point. You see a kind of reflection of yourself, I suppose, which is what many of us want to see anyway. That's what sin is all about. In our heart of hearts, that's what we want. So this is very troubling indeed, because you look for God in all kinds of places and you can't find him. Now, we had a discussion on one of the past evenings in which I participated for a few minutes about whether or not some jobs were better than others and more Christian than others. Seems to me that this notion is relevant there. Another night we had a discussion about Christian higher education, or perhaps even Lutheran higher education. Can you find God in a recognizable way in the educational processes at the institution where I teach? You can find him in where the sacraments are held up and where the word is proclaimed, I suppose, in a variety of ways. God's will is worked through the activities of, perhaps even, heaven help us, those of us who teach. We are imperfect, I'll tell you that. But can God be recognized in a saving way through my halting efforts of teaching history?
even if I were able to compose some extraordinary philosophy of history which proved God existed, would that add up to anything important? There have been dozens of such efforts, and I suppose they're not really terribly important. What's important is the proclamation of the word and the administration of the sacrament. No, what I do is important too, but not in a saving way. Or at least not very clearly in a saving way. That gives me great comfort. I can do what I want to do, what I'm able to do, as well as I can. My vocation is a perfectly appropriate one, and I do it as well as I can, but I'm not proclaiming the word, and I'm not administering the sacrament in the teaching of history of civilization. And you mustn't look for them there. I have responsibilities as a Christian, but they are not those. One doesn't preach in the classroom, or hopefully lecture in the chapel, though that often happens. Well, Luther said, God wears masks. Larva Dei, the masks of God. If you don't look for God where he has said he will be, you won't discover him in a saving way. It's God's universe. It is inhabited and directed by him, but we don't know exactly how that works. You can depend that he is present in education, I suppose. You can depend that he is present in the mysterious workings of the universe, but you can find him in word and sacrament. Okay, so the law. The law is real. It has to be presented seriously as mask or as mirror or as hammer. But then it always has to follow that the word is proclaimed. And that is what the sermon is all about. The law and the gospel have to be held together. There's not a comma between them. I don't know how to describe it to you. You're probably cleverer than I am, and you could describe it better to me. It's dynamic. The relationship between law and gospel is dynamic. You can't separate it. You can't, in some logical or mathematical or geometric or spatial way, separate it, because it is part of the same dynamic whole, and it has to be held together with an incredible sort of tension. Otherwise, the Christian community ends up with cheap grace. I guess grace should be the right hand. It ends up with cheap grace, or it ends up with law. And isn't it true that all too often the church, in its various manifestations, ends up peddling a grace that is too easy and too cheap? It's only half of the bargain. Or with law, morality, ethical conduct, following the rules, reading 17 chapters of the Bible a day, doing all those things that prove that you're somehow a better Christian and are advancing up the rungs of what Christian life is all about. I'm not opposed to reading 17 chapters, but that's not what saves one. All one has to do is accept the grace of God. So, his paradoxes are very interesting things. They're not, you can't displace them, or you end up with either cheap grace or with the law. And I don't know, if I had a way of measuring, it seems to me that the law happens more often than cheap grace, but maybe in Lutheranism it's the other way around. At any rate, that they are both problems that one has to be careful about. Well, that's not strong enough, is it? There are problems that you have to address your whole life to keeping from happening. So that's what preachers have to do. Some of you are preachers, and I don't envy the task of preaching, though I suppose it is as exciting as anything can be. But what the preacher does is preach law and gospel. And Luther says, you can't write about it very well. It has to be announced orally. Luther thought everything had to be announced orally. Things that only made sense when they were said. If you kept them to yourself, they didn't make any sense. You can't separate law and gospel when you think about it. It's only when you say it. It's like loving somebody. If you love somebody and keep it to yourself, it's a very strange thing. But if you say it, I love you. I love you. That's something else. The word is something that can't be kept quiet. The word is something that has to be said, and it has reality, vivacity, meaning, only when it's a noun. So you can't kind of go around skipping and humming and saying, I've got the word in my heart, if you don't say it. And when you say it, you have to kind of disentangle law and gospel in the saying of it. And that's what the sermon is all about. So listen to your sermon next time. And for a change. And see how it is that the preacher separates law and gospel. And if you think that's an easy task, then you try it sometime. You invite yourself into the pulpit and look at that text and decide how you preach law and gospel from that text to the people who are before you, not to the people of the 18th century or the 16th century or some other place, but of this place and this time in the most profound existential way. And you have the glory and the difficulty of being a preacher. And the sermon is the central to what we understand as worship in the Lutheran Church. Yeah.
I'm not sure if this is a part of the paradox, but is it not true that the distinction between law and gospel is not only in the words but in the hearing? In other words, the same thing, I can hear the same text one Sunday, and am I hearing the gospel one Sunday, and am I hearing the law? Is that what I'm getting at? I was thinking of the analogy of a daughter. On one day, when our relationship is halfway decent, I might say to her, you help me do the dishes. She might see that as law. I have to do the dishes with my father. On another day, I might be very angry with her and we might be alienated. And I might say to her, would you help me do the dishes? It sounds law, but she receives it as gospel because it's kind of a word to her. Hey, I'm being accepted back into the group, or my dad says, come on in. Words of law, she hears gospel.
I think so. Certainly, it is multifaceted. I don't know how many times a preacher preaches on the same text in his career, but many times, I assume, with some of the texts. And they never come out the same way. They are multifaceted and infinitely complex, I suppose, and you can see and hear many things in the same text. Moreover, the text makes sense, I think this is theologically correct, because it is guided by the Spirit both in the preacher and in the hearer. And so the text has meaning, comes alive, as it is as life is generated or kind of breathed into it by the Spirit. Again, with the Book of Revelation, that's the problem with what enthusiasts often do to the Holy Spirit. They separate him and kind of hermetically seal him off from the other two persons of the Trinity, and he is a sort of wild card that acts in all kinds of ways on his own. Whereas, if you remember your catechism, the Lutheran Church understands the Holy Spirit as kind of vivifying and making clear what the written word is, the inner word and the outer word. The word is made clear by the Holy Spirit. And so, insofar as it is a sort of a reality that is built into the structure of the gospel, the Holy Spirit somehow makes that clear and understandable. But the message is multifaceted. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Yeah, I can't remember where the first hand went up. Here, I think.
The law of a country, like the journey of the Christian experience of the country divided by a river, and that the bridge might be seen as the Holy Spirit, and that some people approach across the bridge very far, they've only traveled in the law side, but that's home, and then they get partway across, or the other people come from the other experience, and that sometimes the bridge appears to be broken in the middle, and you rigidly hang on to one side and don't ever see the weather or the people or the costume from that.
Yeah, that's interesting. I have a lady in the back row.
I think I'm disagreeing with something you're saying, but maybe I don't understand. What is your definition of preaching the word? It sounds to me like you have to be in a pulpit or in a chapel, or it has to be a preacher. I have heard more saving grace from teachers who love me and communicated grace and love and mercy to me as a person, many times and not always from a sermon. What do you mean by proclaiming the word? What is good news? How broad is
it? Well, I don't think it has to be. It's obviously not only proclaimed from the pulpit, but it most certainly is proclaimed from the pulpit. And that's a central sort of part to what we understand as worship in the Lutheran tradition. It is also proclaimed, I suppose, by every Christian in one fashion or another, in the things they say and do. It's not a formal situation, and the Christian is not a preacher at that, I suppose, at least in some self-conscious fashion, a preacher at that point. But the fact that one can see the gospel is, I think, certainly true. I shouldn't have made such a formal distinction, I think. I didn't mean to do that. And I suppose it can be reflected in actions as well as words, too. But Luther is forever talking about, not necessarily in a formal fashion, but in a relatively formal fashion, standing up and self-consciously proclaiming the word. And so when I'm talking about Luther, I think maybe I'm talking more about the pulpit than anything else. I said a little bit about that on Monday. Luther isn't much interested in visual art. He doesn't care if it exists in the church as long as it's not offensive or inappropriate. But it's something I've been working with in the last couple of years. He's just not interested in visual art. He's interested in music. And he's interested in music because it has words. And because the words can carry a message in the same way as a sermon can or a statement can. But Luther was, I think, a little nervous about the visual arts because the message isn't single in the same way that it is when you use words. Maybe it's not with words either, but at least it's easier to kind of convey a single message with words than it is with visual images. And I think Protestantism hasn't done well with visual images. I think the whole Protestant tradition has done a rocky job with visual images. The Zwinglian and Calvinist churches were much worse, too strong words. They took the axe to pictures and threw them out of their churches altogether and whitewashed the whole area. The Lutherans kept pictures but didn't produce any artists, or at least not many artists, who did very well, whereas we produced a whole bunch of good musicians. So I think Protestantism has a real problem with the visual arts. Part of it was a reaction against some of the abuses in the Roman Catholic churches of the late Middle Ages. Some of it was also a kind of byproduct of Luther's emphasis on the spoken word. And music lends itself to that. Sculpture and architecture and painting does not. The latest word hasn't been said on that, I think, and so some of you can become famous by writing that book. Yeah, Joe.
Well, it seems to me that this is one of the really great vulnerabilities of Lutheranism. We spent so much time with the spoken word and getting the exact right word said that we never act. And we never really concentrate on how that word is translated as gospel word into the action that we do, because we're caught back to the question of how to say it.
Yeah.
And it seems to me it's a very great vulnerability, and one that is evident somewhat in Luther's life, but certainly in Lutheranism over and over again.
Certainly the tension remains. Mm-hmm. We spend a lot of time perfecting the sermon, and then everyone walks in the church and doesn't do anything.
Some of the most doctrinally correct sermons don't seem to tell people into doing what at times would be fairly heaven.
Yeah. I don't know what the response to that is. I suppose I hate to say what Luther would say. as though I know. I suppose he would say that unless it somehow comes to life, not just in the preacher's mouth, but in the hearer's mm-hmm. heart or wherever that happens, it hasn't been effective, it hasn't been efficacious, it hasn't been real. So it has to somehow bring a reaction, or it's not somehow the word. It is a kind of desiccated proclamation. It is a sort of skeleton without life. But it has to produce a hearer that hears and then acts on that. Yeah.
Can you say that the word is Luther's emphasis as a way of specifying? Where can a Lutheran artist go for comfort and guidance and strength in defining his own discipleship by visual images, through visual images?
There certainly are some Lutheran artists and some Lutheran architects who have done first-rate work. But first-rate painting has not been a part of the Lutheran tradition since the Reformation. Now, someone's going to give me a whole bunch of names that are first rate, and I'm going to be embarrassed, but I think that's true. As the Roman Catholic Church, with its with a more relaxed attitude towards visual images has continued to produce a lively church art. I think art in the modern world has become secularized, I suppose, to a remarkable degree. And artists don't think of themselves as, at least very often, as somehow working in presenting the word or presenting something of that. But I don't know the answer. We have Lutheran artists here and people who know a lot more about art than I do, and perhaps they can respond. Yeah.
When you first mentioned that, I was thinking about Lucas Cranach, who was, since he was a real follower of Luther's teachings, wasn't he? And did a lot of stuff. But I, if you know what you're talking about, it sounds like he could be interpreted as a hanger-on rather than as a leader in using the visual arts as the worship form. Albert Dürer was in the same tradition.
Yeah. There are two or three people about the time of the Reformation. Afterwards, not a whole lot happened. But it does happen musically. Mm-hmm. Now, if when Luther had walked through Florence and Rome in the early 16th century, he had seen the Renaissance and had said, wow, this is really great stuff. Maybe we'd have great artists and J.S. Bach would never have written anything, I don't know. Some of it comes from Luther's enthusiasm, there's no doubt about that.
Dan Erlanger this morning was mentioning a book by Callas that refers to the book of Revelation. I don't remember the title, but he talks about this dichotomy between Hebrew and Greek thought, and you were talking, trying to find the relationship between those two, and also drawing a parallel, I believe, between grace and law, and the definition that Callas dwelt on was one that centered mostly on necessity and complementary. They're both necessary and complementary to each other. And being able to sustain that sense of dynamic tension defines an even, not qualitatively necessarily, but a larger and more complete or fulfilled concept of God. So I think complementary, we were looking for a word and complementary came to mind as a result of reading Collins.
Let me say one more thing, and then if you have questions, I'll be happy to try to respond. I always try to avoid questions because they're hard to deal with. My great ambition is to escape from class without speaking the entire 50 minutes of the lecture period, so people will not have time to raise questions. Related to what I've just talked about, and obviously as central to Luther's thought as law and gospel, is this whole question of justification by faith alone. He says that we are justified by faith alone. That's a sort of formula, and Lutherans have applied that formula in a mindless fashion many times. That is, grace is free. All one has to do is accept it. There are no presuppositions or preconditions. You do not have to engage in moral action to deserve grace. You deserve it not because of anything you have done, but because of the gracious activity of God. The Christian, Luther says, is the freest of all people in his essay on Christian liberty. You are absolutely free. God has saved you, and your freedom is as total as it can be. Nothing is demanded. There are no preconditions or anything. In the next chapter of that essay on Christian liberty, Luther says the Christian is the most bound of all creatures. He is bound to everybody and to everything. So that the grace is free, this is the paradox. Grace is free, it is undeserved, it is available to everybody, all we have to do is accept it. Yet as a consequence of that faith, Luther believes that we will spend our lives in service to others. We will end up serving others kind of automatically in a sort of reflective reflexive action, and it will happen not because we in some way calculate, but Luther really believed it would happen spontaneously. Out of gratitude for what God had done, we would all spontaneously turn to others who had not yet received the word or who stood in need of some sort of help, and we would devote our lives and ourselves to such activity. And it, with Luther's personality, it worked out that way. With the personalities of some of the rest of us, there have been problems from time to time. Now, Luther thought that kind of reality of what God had done with grace and faith would so overwhelm people that there would be a sort of artesian well that would automatically begin to flow of love. And Luther is forever talking about the flowing, overflowing love, quellende Liebe, a sort of a love that spews out endlessly and spontaneously and will be directed, as you know, toward the neighbor. So there are a lot of debates about whether there is a kind of ethic in Luther or whether this emphasis on free grace destroys any sort of ethics. And clearly there is a very strong ethical impulse. It's not necessary to salvation, but it will be a sort of inevitable and automatic, a sort of spontaneous consequence of salvation. Not required. Freedom exists. The freedom of the Christian is, Luther says, absolute. But it will happen. So you're free, grace frees you and brings salvation, and then you will bind yourself because that's what you will, I suppose, choose to do in a sort of spontaneous fashion. So law, grace is free, but the Christian is, as it were, bound to others. Not one or the other, but as it were, both. Yeah.
Didn't that bring us to another paradox of it? Although he felt it would be free,
looking at
his own life, and he said it
didn't
work that way for me,
but
he still saw himself as a saint,
had
a sinner, and a saint.
Well, sinner and saint, which is, I suppose, another sort of paradoxical expression. Luther talked quite a bit about freedom. He said, I suppose, like the New Testament, when people tell me that I have to do something, then I kind of refuse to do it. I often think this is why Lutherans are so perverse. If you try to tell them anything, they'll get their back up and say, in a pig's eye. maybe that's because they're German and Scandinavian and any number of other things, too. Luther could be very perverse. If you tried to tell him what to do, he would go right ahead and do something else. But if you didn't tell him what to do, he would be remarkably broad-minded and generous and helpful and all the rest. So... When I was in college, I lived with a marvelous professor who was German, named Jesse Flieger. And when I was at PLU as a student, the law was very important. We called it pietism in those days, sort of residue from an earlier Scandinavian and German heritage. And refusing to drink, not allowing people to drink alcohol, was kind of the sine qua non of Christianity sometimes in those days. And Jesse Flieger used to say he could drink beer to the glory of God just as well as he could do something else. If no one was drinking, he would raise his sign. If everybody was drinking to excess, he would be a sort of opposed to alcohol. In a sense, maybe that's what Luther is talking about here. You are free, but you're bound. You're freed by grace, but you're bound by your concern for your fellows, and will automatically extend that grace to them. This has caused problems in the modern world because Lutherans frequently suffer lapses of memory and forget that they're free. Well, remember that they're free and forget that they're bound, and we have a spotty record sometimes. In politics, in the service, some extraordinary results, but some very sporadic activities also. Well, the tension of being free and bound at the same time is very great, and is a difficult thing to deal with. How does one construct a Christian ethic? Is there such a thing? Can a Christian be bound to do anything, required to do anything, or is that impossible? Run through the New Testament in the next 30 seconds. Can one be required to do things? Or is that something that has to emerge spontaneously? 16th century critics of Luther criticized his ethics severely and said he had created a vacuum at the very center of life, and the result would be anarchy and licentiousness. People would not do anything. They just say, yeah, 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 I'm saved, and to go about and do whatever they wanted. I'm not sure that was the case, but if you don't require people to do good things to be saved, they sometimes forget that their lives should be lives of service to others. There are lots of other paradoxes. I could go on till 5 o'clock this evening, I think, but I don't think I'll do that. You get the idea. I don't think one can understand Luther without taking paradoxes seriously. I don't think one can understand either Old or New Testament unless one takes paradoxes seriously either. So I think at this point Luther is not a systematic theologian, but a biblical theologian in the most profound sort of sense. And one has to take both Luther and the New Testament, Old and New Testament, seriously at this point.